for these ionic engines. They're on almost all the time, you know, year in, year out. 100 watts is going to cut it. They say they need more, and that's why they use the solar cells. Back to you, Dick.
Alrighty. An amazing spacecraft. Good research. And for $54 a year, I think I'm getting my money's worth. Tony may not think so, and that's the American way. We're supposed to occasionally disagree. I mean, John and I and Paul and I imagine Hal, we occasionally get email from people, and I get letters and cards from people who really appreciate the educational value of the guys that gather at something called the internet, the TechNet. But there are people who don't like it. You can't please everybody. It's impossible. Now, the subject that I wanted to bring up with Wes that got started last week, is a kind of a study that we didn't know it at the time, but it really is a study of absolutes. Let me show you what I'm saying.
KC2QIQ with a comment about PET scans. See you later, Dick.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I know earlier in the evening you wanted to know something about PET scans, and being that it's kind of what I do for a living, if you need to know anything on that, after you're done with Wes, I'm more than happy to answer any questions you have about PET scans. KC2QIQ.
Why don't you give us a thumbnail sketch right now? Is it thallium-113 that's being injected when I get a PET scan? Why would there be a positron emission from that material? Why wouldn't it be ordinary nuclear emission? And this is great. In the old days, it used to be this great big array of photocells that gets slowly moved around my body to make that, let me think now, it really is a computer-aided tomography-like photograph that is made. Since you work in that business, Glenn, give us a few words as to how a PET scan, how the material emits, and how it gets detected. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
Yeah, very good, Dick. It sounds like you've got a pretty good background, at least, of what CT is. And basically, the issue with CAT scans and X-rays are the X-ray basically is there's a dose given. The tube creates the X-ray. It's collimated into a certain zone, so it's focused in one area. And you've got detectors in the back, and basically like photo detectors and dosage detectors that limit the amount of dose, and then actually measure and print out the exposure. But the problem with the X-ray is when it hits bone, it blocks everything that basically doesn't have bone in between, or something that dense. The X-ray goes straight through. So if you want to use just to look at bones, it's very good. Let me let it drop for a second. Now, the issue comes up where, let's say you want to look at something other than bones, which now you want to look at digestive system, you want to look at veins, you want to look at something that the X-ray would normally just pass right through. Well, the radiologist and the doctors on site can basically prescribe a nuclear pharmaceutical, which is something that either gets injected into the bloodstream, or you could take it internally, like if you want to look at the digestive system, something that goes in your digestive tract and reacts to the X-ray, so that basically now, instead of the X-ray just passing through, what happens is once the X-ray strikes this nuclear pharmaceutical, which there are many different types depending on what they want to look at. Now, as the machine's going around, it's going to take pictures, and instead of just stopping at the bone, now instead of just blocking, what happens is you get an emission. So in other words, once the X-ray attaches to this nuclear pharmaceutical, you're going to basically get an emission out of it. And now, instead of just being a blocking image, you get a positive, so to speak. In other words, now you're getting, it's not just as if you're getting a shadow, you're also, now it's like getting a light bulb inside there that's lighting up. Are you following me so far, Dick? KC2QIQ.
Now, that's amazing to me. I thought the nuclear medicine material, the nuclear pharmaceutical, was a natural emitter, or an artificially made emitter. I didn't know that it becomes an emitter when an external X-ray hits it. When the X-ray from my X-ray machine hits it, it sort of lights up, is what it sounded like you said. That's a brand new concept that I didn't know about. Back to you, Glenn.
But that's exactly how it's working, Dick. What basically happens is the detectors can be designed. In other words, like if you just wanted to look at the shadow of an X-ray, you could do something very simple, like take a standard photo detector and put phosphor on it. So now when the X-ray hits the phosphor, it's going to light up. And then basically where it doesn't light up is where the bone is. So, okay, that's okay for looking at bones. But now if you put another detector inside there that's looking for something a little bit higher energy, now not only do you get the negative, you create a positive on it. And that's what allows you to see the images in between. It allows you to see veins and digestive systems and heart, all kinds of other things. Because what the nuclear pharmaceutical is doing is it combines with glucose. In other words, glucose is the distributor. When they give you this prep, basically what it does is it finds the glucose. And basically it lines the images wherever glucose is. So it finds the glucose path. That's why for finding cancers and things of that nature, the nuclear particles basically are distributed by the glucose and will form around the mass. If it wasn't properly distributed with the glucose, what would happen is you just wind up with clumps and you'd have dots and things like that, where this way the glucose distributes it correctly through the system, gives you a positive emission, and that's the word PET, and basically the computer can erase the bones and just look at the images of digestive system, circular system, whatever system the doctor wants to see. KC2QIQ.
Boy, it's sounding good. When I combine that with the MRI machine, boy, can we get, in theory, only semi-invasive imaging in three-dimensional space of body parts without cutting into the person. Glenn, is your title anything like radiography physician? If you're allowed to tell us what your position is and what you do, sounds like fascinating work, and I bet you've been doing it for 20 years. Over to you, Glenn, K2RIW.
Oddly enough, Dick, only about 3 years now. I think you might know the company I work for, but I'm a project engineer, and the group that I'm responsible for is designing software, firmware, the tubes. Well, we don't really design the tube, but we, you know, select tubes made by, you know, Toshiba, Varian. We have to design the collimators. We have to design the AEC detectors to protect the person from the amount of dosage that's regulated by the FDA, and also the detectors, basically what they're able to see. And then we also design the generators, basically to power the X-ray tube and control the amount of energy. It's just basically a pulse, and the more sophisticated units are what we call dual energy, where we'll send out packages of pulses that will react with certain detectors to give the doctor a little bit better clarity and more dynamic range in the image. KC2QIQ.
So that then would be based on the energy level of those X-rays and the sensitivity of the range of the detectors. That's what you call selectivity and torsion.
Also, what is AEC?
AEC, Dick, am I making it through?
Beautifully, not to worry.
Okay, AEC is automatic exposure control. So in other words, you want to make sure that the person receives the correct amount of dosage, so in microgray. So basically when you're sending the tube exposure out towards the detector, the radiologist would have to know what the density of the individual is, what type of measurement that they're making, and how much emission, and then to cut it off so that the AEC detector loop basically goes behind the photo detector that's going to take the image and limits the amount of overall exposure so that you just get enough to create the proper image. KC2QIQ.
I shouldn't have you asked to answer, Glenn. Okay, Paul, recognize him. That makes me make sure that you don't get an overexposure and underexposure. And after Paul's question, to go back to Wes's question, that is, it sounded like you're saying that sometimes the nuclear pharmaceutical has the ability to put out two different MEV levels, so to speak, energy levels. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Glenn, are you getting two different doses of radioactivity, one from the substance that you are either, you know, swallowing or being injected with, now plus the machine itself that's transmitting the X-rays through your body, or is this only with the PT scan, or is this both with the PT scan and with the CAT scan, CT scan? Glenn, help you.
I have a comment.
Yeah, sure, Paul. Basically, CT just is the term means computerized tomography, which is basically just a computer-generated X-ray image. So that's just X-ray. Now, when you're talking about PET, now what you're doing is you're adding a positron image, or you're using a nuclear peptide, or what doctors and radiologists normally call preps, and they will assemble a prep depending on what part of the body it's going to go into. There's a prep designed for going into blood, for looking at circulatory system. There are preps that they make to go into that you can take orally, and then there are, you know, for the other end, they make you know, they make tons and tons of preps, and the radiologists and the doctors work together to determine which prep the patient's going to receive in order to create the proper image, KC2QIQ. But yes, there would be a second substrate with a nuclear pharmaceutical. That would be the second type of radiation.
Okay, so the prep is also radioactive.
Yes, it is, and it's distributed through glucose. That's glucose is the key.
Okay, I got it. Very good. So you just plus the dose of the radiation from the PET scan itself. Very good. Key, Glenn.
I am guessing that the glucose gets absorbed by certain organs, and the rate of absorption and the location of the absorption also gives you additional information about coronary thrombosis-like situations. Go ahead.
Yeah, basically, Dick, what it does is it prevents the nuclear material from clumping. In other words, I believe the individual who got the award for discovering this, the doctor basically determined the properties of glucose that it would basically distribute the nuclear pharmaceutical so that it would basically flow and only attach to the outer areas to give you the best definition. So they're really shooting for definition with the least amount of nuclear reactive type of material that goes within somebody's system.
QIQ, KC2. Yeah, we got two people with a question. One was Wes and one was Tony. QIQ, yeah. Wes first, go ahead with your relatively brief question, Wes.
There is a comment. You're talking about PET, positron emission tomography. When Eric started and now Glenn, it's up more. Actually, we could see that as the base on the tracer that is being injected to the body, then that tracer is labeled with the positron-emitting radioisotope, and then that positron will decay. We will have a detectors that would be, if you look at the machine, it's like a ring, and then you have a detectors, and then they measure the coincidence detection of annihilation of radiation. But actually what is happening is that when that positron is being shot out, somewhere on its way, there is a probability of a collision with the orbital electron. When those two meet each other, they destroy themselves completely, and then the 511 kilo-electron volt gamma ray would be created, and that gamma ray will go in 180 degrees apart. So you can have a line from where the positron hit the electron, and that would be perpendicular to the direction, and then you have two detectors on that ring in PET scan. One detector is on left and one is on the right. Now you have a single point. In ideal situation, what you could do is turn the body. But when you turn the body, the person is going to fall out. So what they discovered is at the first PET scan, they have made rotational two detectors only. And those two detectors only were registering different angles, but so that means that in that ring they were turning. Then later on they find out it's very much inconvenient, so they put a set of detectors, one next to the other, so you have dozens of them, sometimes hundreds of them, depends on the manufacturer. And then you see that different angle of that collision, and that's what gives you a tri-dimensional picture of what's going on. But now, I was telling about the different energy level.
Stand by now, let's one at a time. Glenn, is there a coincidence detector in a PET scan? Is there a photocouple, is there a optical array, that's the word I'm looking for now. Is there a set of sensing detectors on one plate that's above you and one plate that's below you, and the two of them both rotate around the body? Is there a kind of coincidence detection taking place with a PET scan? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
In a modern system today, Dick, there's usually one in back. In other words, that's the one that's underneath the patient. So in other words, the tube is going to fire directly at the patient. Then you have one, which is called sometimes the raster wall, that's underneath. And then you're going to have one on either side of right angle to look at the scatter. So, and those are multi-purpose detectors. But the AEC is always on the bottom. So in other words, that's the one controlled by the FDA to control the amount of overall exposure. Think of the PrEP that's being the nuclear pharmaceutical as the color, and basically the X-ray is the light. So what you're doing is without the X-ray, there's no exposure, there's no illumination, so to speak. So you really need the X-ray to light everything up. And basically the glucose is, that's just really working with that nuclear pharmaceutical to give you a nice spread out good image. As far as the detectors go, they're placed, as I said, at 90 degrees and 180. And they rotate with the tube. So in other words, they're moving. In the old days where the patient had to move, you know, which every time you need another side, basically you just can keep on rotating that image all the way around the patient and take a full 360 degree image. KC2QIQ.
The subject of coincidence detection. Why is coincidence detection required, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2RIW?
Well, keep in mind, in the old days when you just did X-ray, you just had shadow. Now that you're adding color, so to speak, in other words, you're putting in a positive emission that's basically coming out, now you can have side angle radiation. In other words, it's a positive emitter. It's no longer, in other words, normally, if you were just looking at bone and CT, okay, you're going to have the generator tube on one side, and you're looking at shadow of bone. Now that you have a glucose-distributed nuclear pharmaceutical in the body basically attaching itself to the tube of the vein or the whole tube of your digestive system around the outside, you're going to get some side scatter. And that side scatter is also useful information that you can feed back into your computer and reassemble the image.
I'm kind of lost here. The thing is that I believe we're talking about two different animals. I'm talking about two gamma rays that has nothing to do with X-ray, although we may say that gammas are hard X-rays. Yeah, we may say that. So I would like Glenn to specify that.
Okay, it's not that sophisticated, Wesley. What's really happening is when you're putting the X-ray and it stops at a bone, you're just looking at a shadow. Okay, so the detector is very, very simple. It just has to do something very basic like exposing a film or lighting up a phosphor with a standard photo detector. When you're getting the additional information from the positive emission, okay, at that point, it's a different frequency than X-ray. So what you have to do is you have to tune the detector now to be a little bit more sophisticated to measure the different frequency, okay, because now, because it's higher energy, because of the nuclear emission that you're getting bouncing off of the X-ray, that basically you're getting a different frequency. So now you tune your detectors to basically higher frequency to accept those images. And then what's nice about that is because now the computer knows the difference now. It knows that the positive emissions are coming through at one frequency range, and that the shadow from the X-ray, it can erase. So in other words, now you can look at organs, and the computer erases the bones and redraws the image of the organs. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I have a comment here.
Yeah, that's a nice symptom. Let me go for a second over to Tony. He's been waiting a long time. KC2UJL, I know you had a question, Tony. K2RIW in the tech net.
Glenn, KC2QIQ, KC2UJL. When my wife was going to New York Presbyterian, before she passed away, she had the severe cancer, a carcinoma around her waist area. And she had to go every so many weeks to take x-rays, and she had to drink like a quart of this stuff, It was either tea or any flavor you wanted. She would drink this stuff, and she'd have to wait for a little while. Then she'd have to go into the x-ray room, and they would take pictures of her abdominal area. Now, this material that she was drinking when you were talking, I guess, has some kind of a nuclear material in it, because when she drank it and she waited a half an hour or so, when they took pictures of her, I guess it illuminated what they wanted to see inside her. Can you put some light on that subject?
Yeah, I'm going to make a guess that that's either a radio opaque material or a radio emitting material. Give us some words on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the group.
Yeah, the type of prep that you're talking about, Tony, is it's a nuclear pharmaceutical. It definitely has a nuclear material mixed with glucose to travel through the system. And what would happen is your wife would drink this substrate, before going into the x-ray, and you'd have to allow some time for it to work through the digestive system. So that would be like an oral version of the prep. So she would swallow that, it would run through the system, and usually they would let you know, the radiologist and the doctor would let you know how long to wait so that enough of the prep works its way to the organ that they're interested in. So it takes a certain amount of digestive time. And then when she would go in for the CT or the PET scan at that point, this way it's they have that nuclear prep in the right areas, and then when they take the scan, they can get a good image of what they were looking for. KC2QIQ.
WB2SSB with a comment.
SSB, we'll pick you up in 1 minute. Tony, was your wife, what's the word for it now? Was she getting either chemotherapy or radiation therapy to try to cure the situation? Back to you, Tony. T2LIW.
She had a cancer that was very rare, and mostly women get it. It's a pheochroma of some sort that goes around. It started with the adrenal gland, and then they removed her adrenal gland, and when they removed it laparoscopically, one or two little pieces of cancer, we call cancer, got out. And after 3 years, she started getting pains all around her waist. And when she went into New York Presbyterian, that's when they found out. By that time, it started making all kinds of problems for her, where they had to remove, pieces about as big as an orange, some pieces as big as a grapefruit that was growing inside of her. She had a really bad, but I was glad that Glenn came on, because it was terrible. For 4 years, we had to keep going back to Presbyterian, which is a very fine hospital. The doctors here are magnificent. And I want to say to you, Glenn, I have a lot of respect for you in the field that you're in. Because, not only because of my wife, but I hope to God that everything goes good for you. I really do. KC2UJL.
Yeah, thank you for that information, Tony. We're all getting a little bit smarter on medical things. And many a patient has to be somewhat informed, in some cases, to help the physician not make the decisions. I could give you a bunch of examples of that in my family's case. The new person who joined us, please give us your call letters one more time and your name, and then proceed with your question for Glenn. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Hi, this is WP2SSB. My name is Joe. I'm a radiologist. I read PET scans and CAT scans and nuclear medicine studies for a living, so I can clarify some of the points if you would like.
Just choose whatever point you would like, Joe, that we're obviously misunderstanding an awful lot of this. You probably worked with various, what are they called, nuclear peptides, I think they were called, and CAT scans and PET scans. Give us a few words on, from your point of view, how well it's working, and my guess is, as time goes on, the contrast and resolution of the imaging, I'll bet, is slowly getting better. Is that true, Joe? WP2SSB, nice call letters, T2LIW and TechNet.
Just WP2SSB. Yeah, you're exactly right. As the years go by, the devices become more sophisticated. A lot of it's based on increasing computer power, too. There are a lot of ideas floated around tonight on the TechNet that are kind of being conflated with one another. There are three kinds of imaging that we've been talking about: CAT scans, nuclear medicine procedures, and PET scans, and each of them uses a separate technique for eliciting the information from the patient's body. They all use very similar computer techniques to reconstruct the images, but the CAT scan uses an X-ray beam. The nuclear medicine procedures use radionuclides that emit gamma rays generally, and PET scans are performed using very specific types of radionuclides that emit positron emissions. Let me drop. So basically, a CAT scan shows you the anatomy with very nice precision. The nuclear medicine scan shows you the physiology. We have dozens of different radioactive drugs that we can administer to the patient. Usually they're injected intravenously. Sometimes they're taken by mouth. And they go to specific organs depending on what disease you're trying to elucidate. The PET scans are the vast majority of PET scans are done using glucose molecule tagged with fluorine, fluorodeoxyglucose, which is a tracer that goes all over the body and accumulates in cells that are metabolically active. Let me drop. So the beauty of a PET scan is that it can show you tumors tend to be more actively metabolizing sugar. Tumors like to eat sugar, so they show up as brighter spots on the reconstructed images. And when you perform this with a state-of-the-art PET CT scan, you've got the anatomy spread out for you, and you've got the glucose showing you where the tumors are likely to be distributed throughout the anatomy. Back to you.
I thank you, Joe. I can tell you've been there a while. You've been in that business, I'm going to make a guess, 20 years. Is that true, Joe?
And at NYU Medical Center since 1973 when I went to medical school there, and I've run the nuclear medicine department for 20 years, and now I'm writing computer software and reading PET scans for a living.
Fantastic. Did you say you had another comment, Tony?
Joe, my wife had, I can't say the word, it's a huge word, it's PHEOCHROMOSCYTOMA. If you could say what that long word is, that's what my wife died from.
I'm happy to help. That's a pheochromocytoma. It's a tumor of, like you said, it's a tumor of the adrenal gland that can be malignant and can spread throughout the body, and unfortunately that sounds like what happened to your wife. The material she drank and then waited an hour or so was probably dilute barium that fills up the digestive tract so that the x-rays that were taken have more contrast. They can delineate more structures, and the radiologist can differentiate bowel from tumor.
Well, Joe, I want to say one thing to you and to Glenn out there. I wish I had the money that some of these billionaires had, because you only live so long, Joey. And if I was a multi-billionaire, I would take whatever I need to live for the rest of my life, and I would donate all the rest of my money to studies of cancer, so people like you and Glenn and doctors can maybe someday make it easy for somebody who might have this disease that might be able to live. That would be a very important thing to me, Joseph, and to Glenn. And back to Dick out there. I want to thank you, Dick. Thank you very much. KC2, United, Juliet Lima.
Hang in there, Joe. And it's time to put up a bigger antenna. I'm only half kidding. I know, Wes, you had a comment. Don't get too long with your comment, because I was going to give you another piece of information tonight, Wes. In 2XJN, K2RIW.
The problem that I was having with all of the gentlemen is that positron emission tomography. Positron is beta. So when we're dealing with betas, we're not dealing with x-rays. X-ray is a side effect, but we're not measuring x-rays. So probably there is a difference between CAT scan and a PET scan. What I was talking about a PET scan. So maybe both of the gentlemen, if they could give some brief about attention.
WP2SSB. I'm not sure I understand the question, Wes. A PET scan is one of the most recent imaging modalities. It gives, its main benefit is it lets us try to elucidate what the function of various organs are and shows us where tumors are. And the fact that it's a coincidence detecting system gives us a state-of-the-art PET scanner has a resolution of about 3 to 4 millimeters, which is significantly better than the older nuclear medicine systems, gamma cameras, that had a resolution of probably a centimeter or a centimeter and a half. Now, also, it's important to realize that a state-of-the-art PET scanner comes with a CAT scanner built in. It's a PET CT device. Nobody buys and uses a PET scanner anymore. It's always a PET CT, or now there are a couple of centers in the country that have PET MRIs. Back to you, Dick.
No, I was talking about the presence of x-rays. Glenn was talking about the x-rays. The PET scan, we're dealing with gammas. We don't deal with x-rays. So that was something that I do appreciate Glenn's comment, but that was something that I got lost in. We don't have x-rays. We deal with gammas. And we, but gammas are created by beta particles, and beta particles plus is positron. Beta particle minus is negatron. And to x-ray, Dick, too.
Okay, so 2QIQ. Joe, tell us why there is a coincidence scanner in a PET scanner. Why a coincidence detector? Over to you, Joe.
Phenomenon. I mean, why did they bother to invent a PET scanner? As I said, its main advantage over the older nuclear medicine gamma camera systems is that its resolution is about 3, 4, 5 times better. We can actually see, I've seen melanoma is one of those tumors that is very glucose avid. It's very, very metabolically active. I've seen lymph nodes that are a couple of millimeters in diameter light up with melanoma centimeter or a centimeter and a half. But again, Wes, I think the presence of X-rays in a PET CT scanner are
QIQ, Dick, am I making it through?
Yeah, give it a go, Glenn.
I think where Wesley's getting confused is with these modern machines. If it's anything that I'm working on right now, these machines are all combined. Is it you have X-ray in there, and the detectors are all combined. In other words, when we're developing the detectors today, we developed a detector that's going to look at AEC control. It's going to do the gamma receptor. It's going to do the X-ray receptor. In other words, all of these elements now are all built into the same machine. They're all inside there. And as I said, when you're looking at the PET, basically the detector is only going to look at the higher frequency energy. In other words, it can detect the difference in the energies. So when it looks at the higher energy, it gets much higher resolution. The side panel scanners, in other words, the ones that are basically at right angles to the other, is adding more imagery. You have more angles that you're looking at, so it gives you higher resolution. So more detectors, more locations, and right angles seem to be the best. This is what at least every doctor I've spoken to tells me. And then when we can take the forward reflection, we look at the side scatter, and we reassemble it. And it's because they give us phantoms that basically we experiment with, and we view the images. And then the doctors basically are telling us what they want out of these images. So basically, and what we can do. So they give us test phantoms, and we reproduce the images until we give them what they want. KC2, QIQ.
Great stuff. And we're going to be discussing this more as time goes on, I can tell. The one other subject I wanted to cover with Wes tonight is the problem of, I'm going to call it absolutes. There is an absolute zero in temperature, and in theory you can have an absolute zero of materials in a so-called perfect vacuum. But both of those absolutes, mankind is never going to get there. You can calculate where absolute zero in temperature is, and they've gotten down to millikelvins, microkelvins, and nanokelvins. Kelvin scale is the absolute temperature scale. But you can asymptotically approach absolute zero, you never get there. And when it comes to soft vacuum, hard vacuum, ultra-high vacuums in a laboratory, you'd be amazed how many particles that are left. Avogadro's number, 6.023, 10 to the 23rd, let me drop. That's the number of molecules you've got in a gram molecular mass of some substance. I mean, air has a molecular weight of something like 29. So 29 grams of ordinary air, oxygen, nitrogen, hydrogen, and so on, roughly 29 grams is going to be a little bit less than 1 cubic foot, 29 grams of air. It's got 10 to the 23 molecules in it. By the time you pull the hardest vacuum you can, and heating techniques, and whatever you can to get as many of those molecules out of the container as you can, you still have tens of thousands of air molecules still bouncing around inside. And so, even on the surface of the moon, this particular website is a Wikipedia website. Where is it now? The surface of the moon has got a very large number of so-called air molecules. There it is. 10 to the 5 molecules per cubic meter on the moon. And you can talk about the mean free path. As you get to a smaller and smaller number of molecules inside of a container, how far does a molecule have to travel before it hits another one? And in some of these very high vacuums, you can come up with distances like the diameter of the Earth as a mean free path. But still, you never remove all of the molecules. Therefore, you can, because of the velocity of those molecules, their average kinetic energy, in your so-called vacuum chamber, let me drop number of so-called, you can try to describe what you think is the temperature by way of the temperature of those air molecules, and that's not it at all. It turns out that when you're in a hard vacuum environment. You no longer have conduction because you're not touching anything. You no longer have any significant amount of convection because there's no air mass that's convecting, but you still have radiation. Radiation never disappears. The most perfect vacuum chamber you and I can create, Wes, if I put a thermal imaging camera in the middle of that chamber, I can aim it at the walls, and by the amount of light at an infrared image, at an infrared wavelength that I get off that wall, I can tell you exactly what is the temperature of that wall. So when you put a spacecraft in a vacuum space simulating chamber, and you think you're making a perfect vacuum, nowhere close. But the vacuum that you make is still got billions of particles in there, and so you and I could discuss whether or not the particles bouncing off the wall, picking up temperature, and then hitting the spacecraft and conveying the temperature to the spacecraft, are the particles doing it, or is the T to the fourth radiation, T to the fourth, by that I mean the amount of signal emitted by something that's above absolute temperature in zero, absolute zero in temperature, is emitting. As the object gets colder and colder, the wavelength at which its peak emission takes place gets longer and longer. You could say that one of the longest wavelengths that was ever measured as far as temperature is concerned was done by Carl Jansky, 1932. At around 15 megacycles with his Sturmer Curtin antenna, the first radio telescope antenna, he measured the temperature of the center of the galaxy, so to speak. You could call that a very far, far, far infrared thermal imaging camera. So you never get zero in vacuum. You never get zero in temperature. And as you control the temperature of the walls, as you control the temperatures of the walls of your space simulating chamber, you are in a certain period of time, you are controlling the temperature that the spacecraft in that so-called vacuum is going to come to. And therefore, if the spacecraft was not exothermic or endothermic, in other words, if it wasn't absorbing heat or giving off heat, it was a thoroughly passive item. And if I made the walls any temperature you and I can envision, I don't care if it's a 5 degrees Kelvin, 50 degrees Kelvin, 500 degrees Kelvin. You give me that temperature of the walls, and if you wait long enough, the spacecraft in there will come to that temperature, even though you think you've done the best possible vacuum you can. I know you and I had some strong disagreements on this particular one last week, Wes. I know we're not going to settle it tonight, but this is my understanding so far. In 2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, my speculation was mainly based on the fact that if you have a point in space where there are no particles, if there are no particles, there's no energy exchange. You have a presence of the photons, but once those photons don't interact with the matter, they have no way to interact with energy exchange. But to support your point, I'm going to give you an example of one of the biggest brains in here, Roy. Sorry, Wes, I must agree with Dick. Temperature, like pressure, is a function of averages, not like individual quantum particles. The temperature of a vacuum is not like Schrodinger cat, with a superposition of being both alive and dead only collapses. To either alive or dead, where the observer opens the box containing Schrodinger cat and collapses the wave function. A true absolute vacuum shielded from an external radiation can't exist in reality. If it would be more accurate to describe is as not having a temperature rather than temperature of exactly 0 degrees of Kelvin. That would be the point that I was saying. Okay, no particles, no collision. The same way that all non-zero rest mass particles can be accelerated closer and closer to the speed of light in a vacuum without reaching that velocity. It is possible to bring any space closer and closer to absolute zero, but it can never reach the true absolute zero Kelvin.
Let me ask you a question, Wes. Assume now that even though you cannot make a perfect vacuum, assume now in the Wesley vacuum chamber, by some magic we could make a perfect vacuum. And I'm going to place two objects in that chamber. Assume the walls are thoroughly insulated and not reacting, so to speak. So I'm going to put two objects in that chamber. One I'm going to call a hot object, one I'm going to call a cold object. Will the temperature of those two objects in this perfect vacuum chamber interact? Will they come to an average temperature? Will the hot object convey some of its thermal energy to the cold object? You seem to be saying, no, it will not interact. I say, absolutely, it will. Anything above absolute zero is radiating, let me call it far infrared energy. You tell me the temperature of the object, I'll tell you exactly what wavelength is the maximum emission. Everything above absolute zero is emitting energy. Therefore, these two objects in your perfect chamber, one's hotter than the other, will be conveying heat downhill by thermodynamic third law, I think it is. The hot object will convey some of its thermal energy to that colder object. You seem to be saying the opposite of that. Into XJN, K2LAW.
KC2QAQ with a comment after that. Okay, very easy. You have two bodies and you have infrared or whatever wavelength of the photon. If that photon doesn't hit the body, there is no exchange of the energy. The collision of the photon with the physical matter makes the exchange. That was my postulate. However, I have a few beautiful notes from Roy, but I have a few puzzles for both of you guys. I ask Roy, and I thank you, Roy, for his answer. Ladies and gentlemen.
Now, you're going into another subject. Will the hot object convey thermal energy to the colder object in that perfect chamber? Yes or no?
No. If there is no photon interaction, they could be hundreds of thousands or zillions of miles away, and if the photon doesn't hit the body, there is no exchange. Enter XGN.
You're telling me the hot object is not giving off thermal infrared energy. You're telling me the cold object will not absorb that energy. Every object has an A over E index, absorptivity to emissivity index. When thermal infrared energy is applied to an object, it must absorb some of that energy. You're saying no. I say yes. How can it not absorb some of that emitted thermal energy from the hot object? Over to US.
What means of energy exchange do you see other than photon? And to XGN.
Tell me what T to the fourth energy is. T to the fourth, in other words, the absolute temperature raised to the fourth power, tells you the rate at which energy is emitted by an object above absolute zero. You're telling me the other object in the chamber has no ability to absorb any of those photons? Why not? It's not a perfect mirror. What's stopping the cold object from absorbing some of those hotter photons? Over to US.
4 minutes. With time, the walls of the chamber, or the walls of the universe, or whatever, is going to redirect the photon, and it's going to make the temperature rise. There would be an equilibrium, but not at this particular moment. No photon interaction, no exchange of energy.
You can't stop those photons from interacting. KC2QIQ, I know you wanted to say something. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, Wesley, Dick is spot on this one. And the reason is, the only thing that you're talking about, when you're talking about distance, you know, you could talk an inch away, you can talk a mile, you can talk 100 miles, you can talk astronomical units if you want, but the reality is it's just distance, okay? So if you look at temperature between two dissimilar temperatures and you just make the distance further away, the only thing you're talking about is the magnitude is the only thing that's gonna change. So in other words, when you're really talking about something like absolute zero, what is absolute zero in perfect vacuum? They're analytical points. In other words, when you draw something on a graph and you continue the line all the way down to zero, you say, but that's an intersection point. Is reality in our universe? Probably not, because right after Big Bang, the at that point, if you look anywhere out in the universe, the energy got dispersed throughout the whole universe. So is there a place in the universe that actually isn't perfect vacuum anymore? The temperature of deep space kind of tells us that everything is something above absolute zero, and that there's pretty much matter dispersed all throughout the universe. So the bottom line is, when you're done, we're always going to be something above absolute zero, and there's always going to be some mass. It might be pretty far spaced apart, but it's still out there. KC2QIQ.
It turns out a thermal imaging camera absorbs those photons. Those photons hit the pixels of the focal plane array, and those pixels get heated by the photons of the hot object. That's how a thermal imaging camera works. It doesn't need air to give you an image. And also the cosmic background observer, and also the WMAX, I think it is, why can't I think of the name of the darn thing? The spacecraft that measured the high resolution background temperature of space, it was measuring those photons through the vacuum of space. We've run out of time. We'll settle some of these things next week. This was TechNet number 1545. Next week we'll dig some of these jazz a little bit deeper. John, roughly how many emails are you getting per week these days when it comes to the mailbag? KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. This week was very slow, Dick. It must be the cold. They've gone down. I've got about 12 emails this week. That was about it. And by the way, anybody has questions, you can forward that to JulietBaker5OscarOscar@AOL.com, and I will forward these to the TechNet, and we will answer some questions. I'd like to thank everybody for joining with us with the net, and look forward to solving all these problems next week. We're all here. We'll have fun. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Dick, what is the size of the photon, and what is the cross-section of the photon, and what is single photon?
That's about it. By the way, anybody have any questions?
Boy, that was a heated discussion. Sorry, I couldn't resist. KC2, let me check. Is there anybody out there at LEMARC who might be able to, or who is responsible for the IRLP might be able to answer?
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
repeater system.
KC2WGB, KC2WGB, K2LIW at St. John.
Hardly rain.